Talking Inclusion with Stephen Copsey.
A very warm welcome to our next Inclusive Employers podcast, Talking Inclusion With. I'm Stephen Copsey, and today we're going to be talking about social mobility, race, and the barriers that some people face when joining the world of work. Before we start, in case you don't know us, we're Inclusive Employers, and we support employers to make inclusion an everyday reality. Our mission is to make every workplace an inclusive employer, where every colleague values differences and can contribute their skills and experiences fully to their organisation. These podcasts are for everyone and anyone who has an interest in inclusion and diversity. In our podcast, we share real-life stories and experiences, learn about best practice, and hear practical advice for employers from our guests, as well as Inclusive Employers' own inclusion and diversity experts. So back to today, I'm joined by two amazing guests, Yasmina Malam Hassam, Head of Employability Services at St Mary's University and co-founder of Own Your Talent. Hello, Yasmina.
Hi there.
And Aminata Punji, who is an Inclusion and Diversity Business Support Partner here at Inclusive Employers. Hello, Aminata.
Hi, Stephen.
Both of our guests today have really interesting stories to tell, so we're going to start by asking them to share their experiences with us. So, Yasmina, I'm going to start with you. Can you give us a bit of an overview of your own background, your identity, how that shaped your early life and potential career aspirations?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. Well, I was actually born in the UK. I'm a daughter of Mauritian parents who actually came to the UK at the behest of the government, because my dad came across joining a program to train nurses to work in the NHS. I was the first child born and first in my family to go to university, where I studied pure mathematics for my undergraduate and took a master's in business studies. I'd say the Mauritian culture derives quite heavily from Indian culture, and my culture firmly believes in education. And obviously, coming from as a child from immigrant parents, you build a certain amount of resilience. And I'd say these have been my anchors that have enabled me to build my career to where it is today. And my current role is the Head of Employability Services at St Mary's, and I also co-founded Own Your Talent, which you mentioned in the introduction. So that's a bit of my background.
Thanks, Yasmina. Aminata, how about you? From your perspective, how has your ethnicity, how has your social class had an effect on your career, your life so far?
Unlike Yasmina, I was actually born in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And I would say my social class was higher in Congo than it was when I came into the UK. Pretty much came in to live with my aunt, my mum's youngest sister, who was, you know, on benefits, and she would get benefits for us, the children. She was legal guardians. And yeah, things like free school meals, I used to actually be really embarrassed about it in school. And then it was like our own little community. And I think it makes you a little bit more determined to not have to live like that. Not that it's a bad thing, don't get me wrong. It wasn't like the food was horrible or any of the sort, but it kind of just makes you want to have better for yourself so you stand on your own two feet. So that's kind of, it's made me a lot more determined, to put it that way.
You mentioned determination there, and I imagine there's been quite a few challenges throughout your life, your career, that you've thought, actually, I'm more determined than ever to try and overcome this. Have you got any specific challenges that you can draw upon and talk about from either a race, ethnicity perspective or from a social mobility perspective that you've had to overcome?
I think from a race perspective, I would say one of the biggest challenges I've had to overcome is figuring out how to show emotion without playing into inaccurate stereotypes. So things such as the angry black woman. Growing up, I went through a lot of things. I grew up in foster care, so I didn't actually stay in care of my aunt. So even growing up in foster care and feeling those frustrations when I was younger, it's something that I didn't understand. But growing up and gaining an understanding of how society sees black women, you kind of have to be not manipulative, but kind of play against. So as much as you want to show emotion, and show how you're feeling and how something makes you feel. You can't, I always feel as though I can't show too much, and I have to be really tactful about how much emotion I show and the audience and how well they know me to understand that, okay, this is not anger, this is frustration, this is not something to be afraid of, this is something to understand, this is a cry for help. And I guess on the social mobility side of things, for me, it's been a struggle maneuvering my career, because I always had to think about bills. I've been living alone since I was 16. So I remember the first time I got a water bill, I was like, water's not free. And just having to think about that whilst picking the type of careers I wanted to do. I think a lot of my life's work was just about, you know, keeping a roof over my head as opposed to doing what I was passionate about. And luckily now I am able to do that. But it did take a while, because I always had to build ahead of passion, if that makes sense.
Yasmina, Aminata talked about having to challenge stereotypes and understand other people's perceptions of you. Is that something you've had a challenge with throughout your life? And have you got anything to add on that subject?
It's really strange, actually, because I've never really understood the stereotype that I belong to. Because I think being Mauritian, Mauritians are from a small island, and there were no indigenous people in Mauritius. So you come from a variety of backgrounds. My heritage just happens to be Indian. I guess the main stereotype that you fall under is, oh, you're Indian, aren't you? But I never really understood what that meant, because I'm not Indian. I don't have that background. So I guess the stereotypes are quite a difficult one to pin down for me. One thing I remember thinking is that I'm not English. So I found it very hard to be English. And I never really followed England in the World Cup. And I never really understood what it meant to be English, because at home, my parents spoke Creole predominantly to themselves, sometimes to us. And I understood it. But my mother, particularly my parents, were not comfortable with us having a foreign accent. So in our case, it was his French accent. So we were never taught our own native language. So I sat between two cultures, the British culture, which, in fact, having worked in France, now I realise that I have quite a lot of, and the Mauritian culture, which I never really felt part of either, because as soon as we went back to Mauritius, I was never Mauritian either, because I couldn't speak the language and my cousins used to make fun of me. So I think I didn't really fall into a stereotype as such, but I was always aware of not really belonging to either the British culture or the Mauritian culture. So I guess that was the one thing I experienced growing up.
So moving on now to thinking about the working world and that transition from school to job, we all have that awkward period, you know, no matter who we are. But if we think back now to some barriers that we've overcome when we joined that workforce, what did it feel like? How did we manoeuvre them? And what can employers do to improve social mobility within their organisations? Yasmina, I'll start with you for this question. What barriers did you face when you joined the world of work? And did you feel that at any point throughout the application process, were your options limited at all?
Yeah, I think I'm just going to dial it back a little bit before, actually, in terms of entry to the world of work. Because I think as a child of immigrants, you're kind of told you work hard and you'll get the career that you want. So that's what we do. We work hard. But actually, when you look back, there are some points within your life where your life could have changed. But because you're from a different race or from a different socioeconomic background, those options become closed to you. So a couple in my life were, I was offered a half scholarship because I passed an exam to go to a private school. But because I was offered a half scholarship and not a full scholarship, my parents earned just enough. So I couldn't go to that private school. So I ended up having a state education, which was actually okay. It was pretty good. But that could have prepared me to go to Oxford. because they learn how to go to Oxford in the private education system. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I did actually candidate for Oxford and failed dismally because I found it very intimidating and I was just wholly unprepared for the experience. So I think that alone, in terms of entry to the world of work, those are two inflection points that could have changed my life and created a very different entry to the world of work to the one that I had. I think also at university, I didn't choose my university on the basis of its ranking, but because it was close to home. I didn't learn or understand how extracurricular activities would help me develop my network or transferable skills. So I didn't really do much of that. I did a part-time job throughout my university and I got an internship by accident. And that helped me get my first graduate job. So none of those things were systemic in my life. And I think that did put me back, I think, in terms of my entry to the world of work. Once I got there, I joined a sales team as an account manager. And on the surface of it, you don't really see inequality because you go into work believing that the playing field is level. And it's only when you observe what's going on around you, or even later with hindsight, I think, that you realise that these barriers exist. Actually, one example that was pertaining to me was regarding my sort of timidity, I guess, from the socioeconomic background and the racial background that I come from, and also because I was a woman. So I was in a team with one other woman, but it was a predominantly male team, and it was a consulting team. We were noticed that we were getting really low profile, crappy projects. And there was no difference with our quality of work. So we wondered why this was. So we started observing our colleagues around us and predominantly our male colleagues. And what we noticed is they would really aggrandize the achievements that they'd done in their previous projects. And as a result, they were gaining very high profile projects. And we thought, oh, that's interesting. Well, how can we do that? We couldn't really see ourselves doing it. So what we try to do is promote each other's work. And what that led to was our work getting noticed. And ultimately, we did get the high profile projects. And I got a CEO award for the last project that I did. But it taught me a really valuable lesson about the need for advocacy. Mm-hmm. And that even though your results are good, and that's fine, if they're not visible, you're not likely to get the progression that you need. So that's one lesson I learned at work to overcome a barrier that I saw.
That's really interesting, Yasmin. I guess they start to call it cultural capital nowadays. And there's been a big focus in education about families passing on things just naturally, like taking their children to the theatre, like taking them to galleries, talking about art and politics over the dinner table. You know, those things that seem a normal part of everyday life for certain parts of society, you may not have had access to. You may not have realised, you know, how important they could potentially be to gaining that cultural capital. Aminata, I saw your head nodding a few times when Yasmina was mentioning that extracurricular activity and not thinking about the importance of those networks and how they could help develop you. Is that something you've come across as well?
For me, it was a little bit different. I actually also had a scholarship opportunity. I encountered a lot of organisations that were set up to help people from a lower social mobility background and perhaps people from care and people that essentially had troubled childhood backgrounds. And so through these organisations, I also got a scholarship opportunity because I think in spite of everything I was going through, I was always bright and you could see it that I liked studying. English literature was my favorite subject and my name would always be put forward when opportunities came. And that scholarship opportunity, the couple were a wealthy white family and I met them at Westminster and it really felt really uncomfortable, for lack of a better way to put it. And the feedback they had given the organisation was they didn't feel as though I was submissive enough. And so I didn't actually get the scholarship opportunity. I remember being really frustrated with the organisation for putting me with people that would want submission from me, considering what I'd gone through. So I think my experience was though the bodies were placed to help, you always had to adapt to their culture as opposed to them adapting to make the environment friendly and ready for you. And I think that for me was a theme even before joining work. I think I then found myself avoiding certain environments. So I didn't shoot for city jobs at all, because growing up, what I heard as a Black female was, you know, you have to work twice as hard for half as much. It's not friendly. So you already kind of start normalizing discrimination, you know, normalizing not speaking out, that this is the norm. This it is what it is. You just kind of learn to maneuver around it. And so I avoided city firms and city organizations and kind of kept to local, because I felt as though, okay, these are people from the same background as me, if not the same childhood troubles, but at least the same economic background, socioeconomic background. So I worked in like local offices, but then again, that meant that I was getting lower pay, not as many opportunities. And I think there wasn't anything in my environment that could have prepared me. And even if I think back to college, for example, when I was doing my A-levels, I was aiming for Oxford and kind of wanted to do it for myself after the experience that I had had. So I was, again, really determined to get there. And I was student union president and I was like campaigning for things. And at the time, I didn't realize how to link everything. But I think looking back at that and looking at me now, you know, working with inclusive employers, I can see a theme, but there wasn't anyone in the college that could identify that, oh, Ami, you know, you're really into X, let's develop this or let's help you. It was kind of something that I was aiming for all on my own without support from anyone. So whenever I did fall short, there wasn't anyone to encourage me or remind me of why I was doing what I was doing. It was all off of my own effort. So I think on that aspect, that's what I would encourage people to do when it comes to, just because we come from a lower socioeconomic mobility background, it doesn't mean that we're not aspiring to come out of that economic background and do more. And it should be helped there. It's almost as if, because you're average, they expect you to aim for average. And that's kind of the support that's there. There isn't a support above that. And then in terms of the workforce, I think for me, I really struggled with the environment. So I'm someone that really struggled with just fitting in, finding my feet, not speaking out, because, you know, growing up, I'd had to defend myself. So whenever I did see inequality of any kind, I was always speaking out about it. And I didn't like to be that person, but I also didn't like to be a bystander. And I also have just always wanted more and better for myself. And if that meant calling things out, then I'd call things out. But again, that support wasn't there. I kind of felt like I had to join and follow suit, and that's how you'd be successful or mediocre, or that's how you'll survive. But I didn't want to survive. I wanted to thrive. So it was always difficult for me.
And Aminata, thinking about that thrive rather than survive, you mentioned working for local businesses. How did you make that transition to a more corporate environment? What gave you that kick, if you like, to decide, I'm going to go and do this and work in a different environment?
It actually happened by accident. So I approached I was working really hard for a soliciting firm in Catford. And, you know, I was working really hard and my paycheck wasn't balancing out, you know, the work that I was doing. And I was doing jobs on the side and I was really tired all the time. And I kind of felt as though I was pouring from an empty cup, so to speak. And so I approached an agency and I said, you know, I want something that pays well. Because I know I'm capable, but I kind of want something stress-free. And I didn't limit to the area. So this was my first time going that route with an agency. And then they placed me in the fifth largest accounting firm in the world. And that was kind of how I was thrusted into the environment. And I did struggle. That's what led me to create the BAME network at the firm.
Yasmin, you talked about, you know, noticing how people behave differently and almost adapting your behaviour in order to compete with them. Do you feel your organisation recognised that that behaviour was going on? If not, do you think there's more that they could have done to, you know, support people from Black, Asian, minority ethnic backgrounds to almost upskill them to that level playing field point?
I think it's an interesting question. Did they know that it was going on? Consciously, no. And it's a really interesting thing, because I don't know whether you could chart it down to the environment in terms of I came from a sales background and then latterly a consulting background. So those are quite male orientated areas. But also, you know, when you come from an ethnic minority, there is a certain lack of self-belief, and that sense of belonging isn't always there. I think Aminata alluded to that earlier. So what you think you have to do, it goes back to what I said right at the very beginning, you have to work hard. So you work hard, you learn more, you build your expertise, and you try and make your case to be promoted or make your case to do your job and as foolproof as it can be. Could the organisation have helped with that? Yes, I think by giving a voice, or at least channels for you to promote your activity in the same way as others without needing to shout for airspace. So I think often the issue is that the environment defaults to the dominant culture. If the dominant culture be male, if the dominant culture be white, whatever that dominant culture happens to be, that those norms of behavior become the norms of behavior that everybody has to adopt. And I think organizations can go a long way to sort of really bring those norms into the group consciousness and say, is this the way we can actually showcase and develop and capitalize on the talent that's in the whole group, rather than just a certain majority of people who happen to be there? So I think obviously organizations have changed. I started work in the 1990s, and there has been progress that has been made, but you know, there's still such a long way to go. And the fact that we're talking about equality with regards to race, equality with regards to gender in particular, still now, and it's at the forefront of the agenda, I think it just shows you how much organizations have to do to make that sense of belonging and that sense of agency, and to build in people that feeling that I have the right to be there and that I've earned that right to be there. I think that's the important thing for me.
So now we're going to think about advice for employers. Why should employers increase their diversity in terms of race and social mobility? Yasmina?
I think it's contextually specific, but certainly in my context, it's really interesting because I'm not only a leader in my industry, which is higher education, I'm also a provider of talent predominantly from underrepresented groups. So from my perspective, it's really important. As a leader, I would say it's immeasurably enhance the quality, impact and reach of the work that we do. And I think there are several factors at play. For example, the diversity of the talent creates passion to drive change in different areas. And I think it leads to innovation because they bring their whole selves to work and they deliver against something that they truly believe in. I talked about Be Smart earlier on in the interview, and that literally was born of love. For a lot of us in the team, we have a very racially diverse team, and we clearly saw from our own lived experience and our encounters with our students the need for that program, and that's how it was born. So I think that's one key example of that. I think secondly, it creates a sense of difference, which leads to productive dissent. I really dislike the label BAME, because I really don't think it describes the complexity and the interest of the backgrounds that you bring to work every day. And because we brought our different lived experiences, we often debated our approach to diversity initiatives from our own experience, but also from those of our students. And we used it to challenge our assumption. So for example, it did lead to better decision making, I think. So with regard to Be Smart again, just bringing that back, we didn't promote that, or actually its successor, Employability Confident, which is for students with disabilities, specific learning differences and health conditions. Neither of those programs were promoted on the basis of a deficit model. They were all promoted on the basis of aspiration, where you want to be, what you want to get there, how you want to get there. Because we got feedback from our students that's what they wanted. They didn't want to be identified as a group that needed helping. So we didn't go that route at all. And having that debate really helped us hone down and get to that. And that creative difference comes from that diversity. And I think thirdly, it enables organisations to learn from the diversity of their staff. Certainly at St Mary's, that really has been the case, because it leads ultimately to better inclusion. My members, certainly the members of my team, they've conducted training on microaggressions. They've written research papers. They've presented at conferences, as have I. And it enables us to promote best practice towards finding sustainable solutions. And now we're broadening that out. So, for example, I am a member of the Institute of Student Employers. I'm now the co-chair of the Diversity and Inclusion Group. So we can start to build and co-create those solutions with employers. So I think it really does create a really great ripple effect that actually leads to tangible solutions.
And Aminata, same question to you. Why should employers increase their diversity when it comes to race and social mobility?
Well, simply put, it actually helps them outperform their competitors. Going into my inclusive employers, employee mindset right now, I think I'm remembering McKinsey stats, but I can't remember the year off the top of my head, but 36% of companies that are more ethnically diverse outperform their competitors, and 25% with gender diversity. And even on a more personal note, when I co-founded the BAME network at the accounting firm that I was working at, I had no experience prior to, besides the running the student union in college. It was a new environment to me. I had identified a problem and started the network to solve that problem, and it became the largest network, though there were existing networks, with 801 people. And, you know, we solved a lot of issues. But imagine the environment was already built in a way that it was welcoming to people like myself. Where else I could have put those problem-solving skills into practice if I wasn't so focused on adapting and trying to figure out my way around this unfamiliar and uncomfortable environment? The skills that are available in these different communities, such as socially economic background or ethnically diverse backgrounds, you're not tapping into that because your environment is even unfriendly, or you don't realize the potential that's there. But you just need to look at the things that we've achieved, considering the barriers that are there for us. Just as a plain example.
Yasmina, we've mentioned Own Your Talent a couple of times. It will be really great for you to give us a bit of an overview of Own Your Talent, what you do, and how you're working with individuals and organisations in order to, you know, improve some of those issues.
So we're a consultancy that focuses on career development. And what we do is our focus is yes on career development, but also with an eye on equality, diversity and inclusion, because we believe that everybody has a right to be in an organization, for an organization to succeed, both in terms of the bottom line, but also in terms of innovation, success, solutions, decision making. You need that diversity of voices at the table. So me and my partner work in that space to try and support professionals to actually take their career forward, particularly professionals from diverse backgrounds. And we work across a range of organisations. We also work with different areas of education. So sometimes we'll work in the MBA space, working with MBAs as future leaders and middle leaders to consider their position and also how they can take their career trajectory to the C-suite. And sometimes we'll work with organisations themselves who are looking at the career development of their people and moving that forward. So that's really what we do. But it's always with a view to understanding how an organisation can capitalise on the diverse range of talent that it has.
A theme that's come out through a lot of these conversations already today has been that almost inherited cultural capital, that inherited experience from family, from friends, from communities. What about when it comes to career inheritance? You know, there are plenty of studies out there that say that if your parents do a job, you're far more likely to actually go into that field. You know, in some cases, 400 times more likely than people who do not have a parent that works in that field. And you're going to have ready-made connections that will help you navigate that career path as well. And obviously that's going to work in reverse when it comes to parents who are maybe unemployed. They're not going to have those connections. As organisations, Yasmina, what do you think we can be doing to try and offset that balance?
I think there are a couple of things that can be done here. And I think employers need to take a really multi-pronged approach to this and look at key transition areas, a little bit that I alluded to in my own story. So the transition from school to university, the transition from university into work, and the progression once somebody from an underrepresented group gets into work and their progression through that. I'd say there is some really good practice. So I don't want to paint a doom and gloom picture, because things like apprenticeships are really good things, because they enable people from perhaps lower socioeconomic backgrounds where the economics don't stack up to go to university to follow a career path, earn at the same time and go into a profession. So those things are really good. There are also other variants to that. So, for example, there's an organisation that I know that does internships with professional bodies at school age, and there's a programme that we run, which I'll talk about in a second, that does a similar kind of thing at university's age to create that exposure to different areas and professions. So there is some good practice that happens. But I would say there's a couple of key things. One, I think universities and businesses really need to work together to broaden the range of opportunities. There's actually a career theory called opportunity structure, which is a little bit like what you talked about, in that if you're in an organisation that's a mining town and that's all you've known, then the chances are you're more likely to go into that kind of profession. So really to organise facilitated exposure to different career areas and progression and professions is really key. So I think now technology through the pandemic has shown that that's possible for organisations to reach a greater range of universities, particularly those that have students from predominantly underrepresented groups. So that needs to happen. But I think more than that, there needs to be that greater connection between people in industry and students, so that they can really get a sense of that organisation really wants me there and I have a place in those types of organisations. So I think things like mentoring and reverse mentoring are really good types of programmes that businesses can engage with, particularly with universities from that have a large proportion of students from underrepresented groups. Virtual internships have been another development from COVID-19 that has also really helped students, and more importantly, flexible internships, because they're key for building confidence, showing what the student can do and that they can do that in those professional environments, but also that they can aspire. I think Aminata talked about that aspiration, that I can aspire to go there. But I also think one thing is really important as well, that these schemes and these initiatives need to actually come at it from a view of building confidence as well and creating learning experiences. I think often internships as they currently stand are some sort of competitive filtering process towards graduate recruitment. And I think having that as more of a learning and nurturing process to enable people from without that social capital to learn the rules of the game will be far more beneficial in terms of those students gaining that sense of I belong there, I can make it, and I've got the support to enable me to do that. I think also understanding of the student context is really key. You know, you could get two students that have both obtained a 2-2, but if one has parents that come from a professional background, they have a solid network, they have traditional qualifications like A-levels, and they come from an area where loads of people go to university, and the other's like first in their family to go to university, they've got non-traditional qualifications like BTECs, they come from an area where hardly anyone goes to university, and they've had to do a part-time job throughout, which one's demonstrated the most progress in terms of barriers they've had to overcome? And they're not easy questions to answer. I'm not saying they are. but they do bear consideration to widen that access to professional opportunities. I do want to talk about Be Smart, which is our program. It's something that we created and we're super proud of, because it was we wanted to do it as a response to the fact that BAME graduates were less likely to get into professional backgrounds, professional occupations, and they were less likely to have industry-specific work experience, and they tended to be less well-paid when they did get those graduate roles. So again, kind of echoing what Aminata was talking about earlier. But there were two key differences that were built throughout the programme, and the programme consisted of mentoring, skills development and professional development activities, and also flexible internships. With regard to the mentoring, we made sure that the mentors had the same commitment to diversity that we had. And that was really important to build that sense of confidence throughout. The flexible internships were also key, because often students had to make a judgment call between taking their part-time job, giving their part-time job up to do some professional work experience. Because these internships were flexible, they didn't have to make that judgment call, and they could do both. So that really enabled them to get that professional experience, and it was a learning experience too. And with the leadership work, what we wanted to do there is we wanted to enable students to learn as future leaders that valuing their difference and articulating that value were key to them gaining that sense of belonging in the workplace. We just did some preliminary evaluation on the first year of that program, and actually 79% of students said that their confidence had improved, and 66% said that their sense of belonging with regard to the university had also improved. So it just shows you that just by thinking a little more creatively and differently about those kind of programs and working with companies to develop them, you can really build something that makes an impact.
Really incredible statistics as well there. Those are some really powerful numbers. Aminata, from a workplace consultancy perspective, what can inclusive employers do to support and advise organisations to, you know, try and improve social mobility?
I agree with a lot of what Yasmina said, and I think they can be applied in both inclusive employers and other organisations. So even things such as when you approach, for example, schools and colleges from a lower, from a bad, quote unquote, bad area or lower socioeconomic backgrounds, there's still a cap. For example, you still say, I don't know, you need a minimum of 3 C's, for example. But what you're doing is, even in that environment, you're still excluding the majority. Like Yasmina said, it really is case sensitive, because I think things have changed a lot from especially my own generation. But, you know, 3 D's, you know, could be equivalent to someone's C's, depending on what your background is. Do you have the right resources at home? Do you have the room and time to study? So though typically a D, you know, isn't great, but is a D great considering where the individual has come from? So when we are going to these schools and colleges, are we realistic with our expectations and the criterions that we're putting in place? Is that inclusive, or is it actually exclusive even in that environment? So where you could capture 20, are you only capturing 5 because your criterias are the same as if you were in a different environment? I think that's really key. And I think also having a clear trajectory. So you start here, this is where you could end up. And it's really clear, so the individual knows, okay, I need to do X and Y. And I think with us, in terms of inclusive employers, this is something that we can definitely help to encourage. You know, don't just welcome people from a lower socioeconomic background or a BAME background in. Make it clear what opportunities are available for them. Can they reach the top? How do they reach the top? What are you going to do to help them reach the top? Are you ensuring that through us you're getting all the best trainings that are available with inclusive employers? Are you doing the IES standard so that, you know, to make sure that you know, you're a fair employer and you're meeting all the needs to be an inclusive workforce, so that the environment itself is welcoming, your people are open and they are practicing diversity of thought themselves, making sure they're not biased. And then also, is there a clear progression route for people that come from a lower socioeconomic background or the BAME background? So everything is working together to ensure success.
Thank you to both my guests today, Yasmina.
Oh, thank you.
And Aminata.
Thank you.
To find out more about how inclusive employers can support your organisation to attract, recruit and develop people from a diverse range of social and economic backgrounds, visit our website at inclusiveemployers.co.uk. That's inclusiveemployers.co.uk. For Inclusive Employers members, we have resources on social mobility and anti-racism on the members area of our website. On the next podcast, we're going to talk about neurodiversity. We'll hear more stories and experiences and offer you advice on how you can help neurodiverse people to flourish in your workplace.
You've been listening to Talking Inclusion with Stephen Copsey. If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, then please subscribe and leave a review from wherever you get your podcasts.